I called this piece Living the Inherent Worth and Dignity of Every Person. And I think it stands alone, but I just wanted to mention for those of you who don't know, I'm part of the administration at Pine Street Inn, so I'm not a direct caregiver. It was a Friday night in the summer. One of my donors and regular volunteers had been in to serve dinner in the Women's Inn. "I love coming to Pine Street to serve," she said. Her son was not with her this time, as at 16, he had reached a size and developmental level that prevented her and her husband from successfully continuing to manage his Asperger's. Increasingly, he was becoming dangerous to his parents and to himself. She had told me when she made her first major gift to Pine Street, unexpectedly from a solid middle-class family, that she did so knowing full well that due to his issues and despite all they would do to help him, her son might very well wind up at Pine Street Inn as a guest one day. As I left the conversation with her, I walked out through the Women's Inn into a beautiful summer evening and the prospect of the weekend. This anticipation on Friday evenings is one of the best feelings I know. As I was about to leave through the front entrance, a woman stopped me and asked if I was someone she knew. I said I didn't think I was, and as it turned out, she had confused me for someone else. There was a pause. I asked her if she was okay, and suddenly she was spilling out her story along with her tears. She had never been to Pine Street before, but had made the painful decision to leave her longtime partner as his drinking was worsening dramatically. She missed him terribly and felt guilty at choosing herself over the relationship. As she told this to me, suddenly it felt like two girlfriends crying together over a breakup. It was a universal feeling that anyone who has loved another has experienced. In those moments, what so many of us want is just the comfort of sharing the hurt and anguish with another who understands. Understands because it connected us immediately. My eyes filled too, and I reached out for her to assure her she would be okay and reaffirm her decision. As she receded back into herself, she set her shoulders and jaw and nodded, blinking back the tears and nobly trying to smile. It was going to be okay, especially because we had shared that moment. People become homeless for as many reasons as there are people. For some, it is addiction. For others, it is crime. For still others, it is poverty. And for many, it is mental illness. We have level 3 sex offenders at Pine Street who, upon their release from prison, have nowhere to go and no way to make a living. We have people staying with us that have done unspeakable things to their parents, siblings, children. It is good for good reason they have been cast out of their family unit, not to be trusted. We have people who are working full-time and coming home at the end of their long days to a homeless shelter, where they sleep with hundreds of other men and women and adjust to the institutional routines as mandated by shelter life. Shower at 5:45 a.m., breakfast at 6, out by 7:30, one bag only. Can you imagine your whole life in one bag? And then there are people who won't come into shelter, but instead choose to stay on the street. They cling to pets, to partners, or whatever it is they love. For others, they cling to an illusion of independence, of the illusion that their condition is temporary, easier to face than confronting their own failure through admission into the shelter. Some are simply too mentally ill or have deep fears of crowds, strangers, contained spaces, the shower, so they stay out. I have traveled on the outreach van twice, going around the city, checking on those who won't come in. One of the nights, we turned down a side street in Southie. I saw a man sitting on an overturned milk crate under a street lamp, doing a crossword puzzle. It looked like a stage set. We got out and greeted him, and he was happy to see us. I introduced myself, and he responded in kind. We all chatted a bit, making easy, relaxed conversation. When it was time to leave, I said goodbye, calling him by name. And as soon as I said it, I realized I hadn't gotten it right. I apologized, and he said, "It's okay. It doesn't matter." It cut right through me that he had so little belief in himself that he didn't even demand or expect to be called by name, the right name. Slipping away, becoming nobody. The caseworkers who visit him every night told me he suffers from a seizure condition that prevents him from maintaining a regular job. Diagnosis and medication to treat it are elusive, and even they wouldn't know about it, but he happened to seize one night just as they were about to conclude their visit. As we drove away, there was something enormously lonely and forlorn as he returned to his milk crate and street lamp and crossword. So alone. One of the volunteers' favorite forms of service is game night. Game night involves bingo, snacks, and lots of $5 gift cards for prizes. Some players have trouble with language. Some players have trouble with hearing. Some have trouble with fine motor skills, and some are too high or otherwise altered to play. Nevertheless, on countless occasions, I have seen guests helping one another, translating, repeating the numbers, helping someone to play their card. When someone wins, everybody applauds. More than once, I have seen the individuals who win giving their gift cards to others who haven't, or announcing that this time the prize would buy a Christmas present for a family member. The irony of the shelter is that in the sea of humanity, each is a lost soul unto themselves. The men and women at Pine Street are desperate to talk and to be listened to be validated, and to be seen. Their traumas and suffering are so great, it is sometimes difficult to imagine how someone can get out of bed every day and face their reality. But get out of bed they do, and with each day, each volunteer, each case manager, or kindness from another guest, people move forward in their lives, incrementally, over weeks and months and years. People do move forward. Not all of them, but some of them. And it is always a miracle and a wonder to behold. It teaches me that the most inspiring cases, the most hopeless individuals, the most extreme situations really can change, really can improve. The human spirit, it is truly inspiring. Bearing witness to this miracle never ceases to be humbling and inspiring. Stuart lived in one of our permanent supported houses, which happens to be located next to my office. This office has an innovative program that rehabilitates abandoned dogs. The men in the house can relate. This was the first Housing First house to open at Pine Street. It was a new program that used housing as the stabilizer to help people get sober, trained, healed, rather than the opposite, get sober, and then your reward can be housing. Stuart was one of its first residents and had spent the previous 25 years drunk and living behind the Boston Public Library. A Vietnam vet, I would see him mornings out walking the dog as I came into work. I introduced myself, and soon we had a nice routine of saying good morning and making small talk. Stuart had a very gentle presence, but always seemed to me to be a shell of a person, fragile and empty, with limited words and expressions, the ghost of a smile. Not surprising, really, given his years of alcoholism living on the street. One morning, Stuart said he had something to tell me, and without waiting for me to ask what, he said he had found himself an apartment and he was going to be moving out. As the days passed, he would give me updates, such as the cable was being connected today, or the power was being turned on. He was excited. And then I didn't see Stuart on my way in. I asked about him, and the case manager said he had to wait an extra month as the stress of the transition had made him fall off the wagon. But that happens, she said. And so they just waited a month till he had calmed down and become more stable, and then he had moved. One morning, driving into work, I saw a familiar jacket. It was Stuart, out walking in his new neighborhood. We had a brief conversation, and I left him with his wisp of a familiar smile, astounded that he was living life independently, quietly, and on his own terms after so many years on the streets. The magic of Pine Street exists in the acknowledgement of human dignity that is at the basis of all the interactions between our guests and staff and volunteers. It was something Paul Sullivan taught us and continues to live on today. Witnessing the struggles against such great odds each and every day is humbling and helps to connect us with our own humanity in an even more powerful and direct way. When you can't fix someone's alcoholism or schizophrenia or unspeakable traumas, what you can do is listen, say hello, serve them food, and in doing so, acknowledge the shared humanity between us all. It's the least and the most we can do.
These words of the American theologian Reinhold Niebuhr have stayed with me ever since I first heard them. I paraphrase them slightly here. Nothing of worth can be accomplished in our lifetime. Thus, we must be saved by hope. Nothing of worth makes complete sense at the time. Thus, we must be saved by faith. Nothing of worth can be accomplished alone. Thus, we must be saved by love. Nothing of worth can be accomplished in our lifetime. Nothing of worth makes complete sense at the time. Nothing of worth can be accomplished alone. Let me introduce you to a guy named Kenny, not his real name, of course. I work with him at the Veterans Hospital, but it's not his veteranness that's the focus of what I'll talk about today. Those days are long behind him now. When I say I work with him at the VA, what I mean is he comes to me for treatment. I'm his psychiatrist. Kenny's been through high school, he lives alone, and he always has since he left his family and finished military service. He doesn't work, though he's tried and failed again and again. He's pretty heavy, and he has these ticks around his mouth and his fingers that make him stand out in a crowd, none of which makes it easy for him to find a job or meet girls or settle down and do all the things that most of us think are worth, make life worth living. And, oh yeah, he has this unfortunate tendency to mix fantasy with reality. He knows he's not the younger brother of Jesus most of the time. He knows there's no devil on his shoulder fomenting Armageddon that only he can prevent most of the time. And he knows that life is not so dead-end, worthless, and confusing that he might as well go around and kill himself. This he knows most of the time. Nothing of worth. Nothing of worth. Nothing of worth can be accomplished in our lifetime. What actually is to be accomplished with Kenny? Clinicians know from experience treating tens of thousands of people like Kenny that likely he'll grow obese and shake and twitch and that his periods of lucidity are by no means guaranteed. And to what end? Earlier this year, Kenny had an HIV scare. He was feeling good enough with some medication changes we'd made that he decided to go out and start dating again. Well, I'm pretty sure that his idea of dating involved an exchange of money for services. And one day he came in petrified that he'd contracted HIV, and not without reason. Lo and behold, he turned out to be HIV positive. After several weeks of testing and consulting and more testing, we determined that he was one of those very rare individuals who has false positive for HIV. That is, he hadn't really contracted the disease at all. "Well, Kenny," I said, enthused by his new lease on life, "what are you going to do now with the rest of your life?" After a brief, perplexed silence, he answered, "I don't know, just keep on keeping on, I guess. Nothing more." But here he still is, and here I still am, talking together. So now he knows to choose his girlfriends more carefully. And some days of lucidity and good mood are not to be sneezed at. This is the essence of hope, that these better days, that the dignity of keeping on during the worst days will multiply, ramify and intersect over days and lives and eons and stretch out over the earth. Nothing of worth makes complete sense at the time. It doesn't really make sense, does it, for me to be sitting with Kenny any longer than it takes to renew his medications and make sure he's not going to kill himself before the next time I see him. There's no cure going to happen in Kenny's lifetime or mine. Money talks, and certainly most of the money and research on serious mental health conditions goes toward finer and finer studies of genetics and imaging and neurobiology that propose to find cures for these conditions. Money talks, and most of the money in healthcare says that conditions like Kennedy should be fixed in a relatively short period of time. Let me say here emphatically that this is not the approach that the VA healthcare system takes to veterans with chronic mental health conditions. And that's a big part of why I've stayed with the system for over 25 years. And Kenny and I go on talking. He knows he'll be playing with pain for the foreseeable future. And rest assured that being with Kenny is not in the big money picture. It simply makes no sense. Perhaps you've heard the story about Jimmy in Sunday school, who was asked by his teacher, "What is faith?" Jimmy answered, "Well, faith is when you believe what you know can't possibly be true." Well, maybe the essence of faith is more when we act, yes, act, to align our lives as best we can with something so vast and so compelling and so good that we have no hope of ever comprehending it fully. Nothing of worth can be accomplished alone, and so we must be saved by love. But how do we love? What do we do? What do we do with and for and to the Kennys in our lives? And we all have Kennys in our lives. I talk today from my medical frame, but I trust that you will readily think of people in your own life and work, which, like mine, undoubtedly is populated by a plethora of insatiable bosses, crotchety relatives, misbehaving children, and especially all too many ill-informed and misguided zealots who sit at the other end of the political spectrum. Medicine, and we physicians most of all, have always taken the rap for being paternalistic. It basically is, do what I say or you die. Okay. This is not always bad. I've given Kenny my share of unambiguous directions, sometimes with a tail of or else tacked on. In any event, there's not a lot of choice in this mode of being. It's a lot of doing too. Less frequently, we physicians also take a rap that's more typical laid on social workers, nurses, and other touchy-feely do-gooders. This is the rap of being too maternalistic, and this approach says, in essence, I'll fix your problems if you just stick with me long enough and loyally enough. For physicians, it's, I'll find the right combination of medications to set your world right. And for therapists, I'll just find the right therapeutic insight and I'll convey it so incisively that all your conflicts will be resolved. And for all the others in our lives who are not just acting right in our humble opinion, I'll come up with just the right argument and your priorities and beliefs can't help but be realigned for the good. The maternalistic approach to life's problems involves a lot of doing for, and you probably already know this. It's exhausting. There is a third way of being with the Kennys in our lives, even those Kennys who get so befuddled that they think the fate of the universe hangs on a single twitch of their thumb. This third way remakes our being together more like a coach and an athlete. The coach has some special skills and also has the unshakable will to cheer with delirious optimism at all times. But the coach never forgets it's the individual there with us who's the one that's running the race, not us. Kenny wins and Kenny loses, and he does plenty of each throughout every month. And the most important thing I can do is to be there coaching, advising, cheering, and on occasion laying down the law. The most important thing that I can do is be there with Kenny as he runs the race, his race. I'd like to close by saying something about the power of love. It's overrated. Really, it is. Love does lead us to do many great things and also many dumb things. And on a day-to-day basis, it's not in the classical sense what keeps us hanging in for the long run with the Kennys of our lives. For me, there's something likable about Kenny. I don't know, maybe it's the occasional twinkle in his eye or his gentleness, or maybe it's just the fact that he has a 14-year-old, 15-pound mountain of a cat he calls Cosmo. Love, if it's doing all it can, opens us up to just plain like the other person. It helps us to get out of our own way and see more clearly who's around us. And who's around us is fundamentally good and of worth. As the Quakers say, there is that of God in everyone. Love gives us the perspective, the strength, and the power to like the world around us. And make no mistake about it, Never, ever underestimate the power of like.